Good afternoon, and thank you for supporting Lakeshore Public Radio on the dial at 89.1 FM and streaming worldwide at lakeshorepublicradio.org. It's time for Midwest Beats, a program all about music and people who make it, and in this case, people behind it. Coming up the second hour, my musical guest is Giovanni Taliaferro. He is the director of memorabilia design at the Hard Rock Cafe and Casinos. He's going to talk about the 240 venues across 69 countries and how he decides what goes where. And, of course, we're going to focus on the brand new one right here on Burr Street in Gary, Indiana, opening up next month. But the first hour, we've got Giannis. Giannis is an internationally famous artist and album cover designer who's worked with acts like Uriah Heep, Deep Purple, Styx, Quiet Riot, Grateful Dead, Allman Brothers, and more. So Giannis, coming up after this. Good afternoon and welcome back to Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Tom Lounges and it's time for Midwest Beats, a program all about music and people involved with it. Today we've got two great guests coming up the second hour starting around 2 p.m. will be Giovanni Taliaferro. Giovanni is the director of memorabilia design at the Hard Rock International, which includes the casinos and the cafes. There are lots of them, 240 venues across 69 countries, the latest being right here in Northwest Indiana in Gary on Burr Street. It opens up May 14th. We'll talk to Giovanni about his role in bringing it here and how cool it is to deal with all these great historical artifacts. That's coming up next hour. This hour, in just a few moments, we'll meet Giannis. Giannis is an internationally famous album cover designer. He's a poster creator. He's worked with a who's who of all the great rock and roll talents. Over 350 classic albums have been designed by Giannis, including some by the Grateful Dead, the Allman Brothers, Quiet Riot, Styx, Deep Purple, and Uriah Heep. We're going to talk to him about the process of creating some of these great memorable album covers, how he got into it, and more. Let's start off with something from one of the albums he helped design. This is Uriah Heep from 2008 and Wake the Sleeper. Wake the Sleeper, Uriah Heep, taking you back to 2008. That is the title track, and it's emblazoned on this beautiful piece of art of Middle Eastern-looking culture. It's a Buddha-like temple, and it was created by my guest this first hour, Johannes. He is the international artist and designer, born in Athens, and immigrated to the United States as a teenager, and is one of the guys that's created all these memorable albums that we have seen and grown up with, from the likes of Uriah Heep, Allman Brothers, Deep Purple, Dream Theater, King Crimson, Skinner, you name it. He's probably had his fingerprints on it. And today we get to talk to him about that wonderful career and what he's doing now that things are starting to open up in the arts world again. Johannes, welcome to Midwest Beat.
Hey, man, how are you? Hell of a opening. You got me blushing.
As well-deserved, well-deserved. I love this album, by the way, this Wake of the Sleeper. We just had Mick Box on the show not too long ago, and we talked
happy days, right, with Mick. Happy days.
Yep. He is a talker, I'll tell you. We were supposed to do an hour and we wound up doing almost 2 hours with him. Loves to talk, loves to make music, and he spoke very highly of the graphics and the covers, because I brought that up. Uriah Heep is even pre-Johannes era Uriah Heep. Some of the great stuff Roger Dean did. Amazing cover art that turned a lot of people onto their music. I myself remember going to stores and buying a lot of the old Asia and Yes albums just because of the cover art, thinking, if the album looks this cool, it's got to sound good inside. And that was not always the case. But I'll tell you, you guys have a big part in creating the rock and roll heroes that we all grow up with just because of the graphics that you do.
Well, I was just like you, Matt. I was just the same thing. The first album I ever bought as a kid was Demons and Wizards by Uriah Heep.
Great record.
And, I was like 12 years old at the time, 13, I think. And I remember getting it and listening to music, and I was just completely transfixed, you know, looking at Roger Dean's artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Thought, oh, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. And, you know, that was it. You know, the seeds were planted back then. I didn't know that was Roger Dean or who Roger Dean was. It was the artwork really caught me, you know, really grabbed me. I remember I told this story to Mick. I was so mesmerized by it. So it was in Athens, it was, you know, the old boys school, and it was physics class the next day. So I was just bored out of my wits. You know, the professor's sitting there, and he's spotting off whatever, and he's walking in between the aisles as he's spotting the big thing. So I started with a pencil, drawing the wizard on my wooden desk,
mm-hmm.
and then I completely got absorbed in it. And by the, you know, three quarters of the way into the lesson, I had like drawn the whole record cover in pencil on my desk, and I became keenly aware there was silence in the room. All of a sudden, I looked up, and there's the teacher looking at me. I'm like, uh-oh. And he's like, well, looks like we have an artist in our midst. Yeah. And so I had to stay after school and wash all 40 desks. That was my punishment for what I did. Right? So I told Mick Box when I met him, we're talking. I said, hey, you owe me because I suffer for my art for you.
That's too funny.
That was the whole beginning. I mean, little did I know that, you know, at the time, that many decades later, actually it was two albums that I bought. I bought that and I bought Machine Head by Deep Purple. And little did I know that, you know, many decades later, two of those guys, both of those bands, which I idolized, would be my clients and I would be working with them.
Right. I was going to say, so, could you imagine, you know, back when you were buying the albums and you know, drawing your drawings and hoping one day to be able to be like them, that some of these very artists that inspired you would be your clients and would be your friends. I mean, that's got to be kind of a mind blower for you.
It is. It's. I still have not gotten over it. Here I am now. You know, an old man, right? You know, four decades into this, and I'm just no. I still get that rush. You know, because the whole thing was to be able to collaborate with another artist in the situation, a musician. And when you scrape away everything else, all the commercial duties and talking to agents and managers and record company people and creative directors and this and that or all the other stuff that comes with it, that you're dealing with, a major act and there's a lot of money on the line and there's tours and all kinds of, you know, external pressures.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, it's me sitting down and this guy plays me a piece of music and he goes, what do you think of that? You know, what does that make you think of? And I say, you know, I'm kind of thinking of this. And then turns around and he goes, yeah, man, that's really cool. Like, yeah, that's a great interpretation of my music. And that's it. That's what it is when you strip it all down, right? I mean, it's just an exchange of creative between an artist and a musician, and we just kind of feed off each other. And then everything that follows after that is the after product,
you mm-hmm. know,
merchandising this, that, stage designs, whatever. And I never got over it. I thought I would after a certain time, but it never sinks until the end. And a specific story, and I hope I'm not taking too long.
Oh, no.
To answer your question, a specific moment I remember when it hit me like that was when we did Deep Purple. This was 1997. So the first time I did was the Abandoned cover for Deep Purple. You know, I had missed the Richie Blackmore era, you know, which was, you know, my favorite was really young. So that's when I had become, you know, known in the industry. I was getting commissions. So anyways, the guy who's the creative mind in the band artistically is Roger Glover.
Right.
So I spend all this time with Roger talking and hanging out with him at his house and just going through things and exchanging and working all that. And at first, you know, I was in awe the first time I met him because, Jesus, this was the guy that, you know, played on Smoke on the Water, you know, I mean, this was Machine X. And I would always try to control myself because I would be always asking about 1,000 questions being a fan. Like, okay, you know, like when you guys did that song, you know, how did that come about? What happened? Or what happened in Montrose, you know, and when you recorded, you know.
Right. And was Frank Zappa really there, you know?
Yeah, Space Truck and everything. And I was privy to all these conversations between him and Ian Gillan and this and that or whatever. But you get sort of over it because, you know, there's all the pressures of getting the artwork done and getting to all the territories and this and that and the credits. And, you know, then you get caught up in doing the project. So you don't have time to think. And you get so used to hanging out with them or talking to them. It is just like, you know, when you go to that cafe and you're hanging out with your best friend, you're having a cup of coffee, you know. It doesn't really sink in that you're dealing with legends, you know,
mm-hmm.
yet. And anyways, we finished the project, was done, you know, we got all the artwork, all the different components. I did the stage designs, I did the merchandising designs, you know, blah, 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 and everything. So I think it was the spring. So that summer, they toured with Emerson, Lake & Palmer and Dream Theater. It was Dream Theater was the opening act. ELP played, another huge fan of that I am, of Keith Emerson. And then the headliner was Deep Purple. So I got the call from the manager, and he said, listen, you know, they're playing, you know, in the city. You want to come down? I want to see the gigs and say hi to the guys. I'm like, yeah, sure. So me and my brother, who was my partner in my agency, our wives, so we went to the concert. And so I walk in, man, and it's all of a sudden that's when it started to hit me. Like I'm looking around, all these people walking around with T-shirts on my artwork and everything. And I, you know, we had great seats, you know, I think third, fourth row center. And, you know, with our VIP passes and everything. So we sit down and the lights dimmed. All of a sudden this massive backdrop on my artwork comes up behind them, you know. And they start with Highway Star.
Wow.
And they start kicking in. And, you know, the crowd just goes into a war. All I remember was me being 13 years old in my bedroom, you know, my headphones on, listening to Machine Head, just staring at the artwork. And that's when it hit me. I turned around, I just grabbed my brother by the shoulders and I said, dude, we did effing Deep Purple, man. we did Deep Purple. I mean, I was in tears, you know? And and this happened several times to me. It happened at the Beacon Theater shows with the Allman Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Because the chances of what I did for a living or how it happened were so astronomical. I mean, I remember telling this to my father, and I might as well have told him I was going to become an astronaut and go to Mars. It made as much sense to him, you know?
Right.
We immigrated to the U.S., working at my uncle's restaurant, 16, 17 years old, and I decided I was going to do record covers as a living. So the chances of a Greek kid who had no art training, they didn't give art in school, and he was going to go and do artwork for famous rock bands. I mean, you know, it was just such an improbable story. I mean, it was just, you know, you might as well win the lottery, you know,
right,
or something. And it happened. It was just a series of events. By the time I was 18 or 19 years old, I had done my first record cover for Columbia Records. And so things kind of just started to fall through from there. In the 80s, of course, is when things really started to take off for me.
Right.
And, you know, by now it's established. But it was just, yeah, it was just nuts. I've never gotten over it.
It's really opened the door for you in so many aspects. I know you worked with MTV, you worked with the record labels, you were designing the stage drops and things and the merchandise. It just seems like it would almost be overwhelming because you have so many clients that really have so much cool artwork. I don't know when you would find time to create all of this. The thing is, some art already fits with an album or a project. Point in case, Molly Hatchet with Frank Frazetta. That stuff just lent itself perfectly. Yet other ones, you have to, as you said, sit down with the artist and you're commissioned to create something unique for that artist. What's the process like? I mean, how long does it take you to wrap your head around what they're trying to do musically and to make the art that sells it from the outside work to properly represent it?
Just life, you know, the ideas that come in. I mean, you know, you mentioned Frank Frazetta, but the artwork that was done for Molly Hatchet, you know, that was a painting Frazetta had done as a paperback cover. So that was a situation where, Frank painted artwork. He's a brilliant artist. I mean, God bless him. And he, a whole genre he created. So, you know, he created artwork, you know, for a certain thing. He owned the rights to the artwork. The art director of the record label, you know, they were looking for options for a record cover, which is one way they do things. And then they just sort of have a collection of illustrators, artists, or agents they speak to who push product to them and they take it. And that's one way to do it, you know,
mm-hmm.
You get a call from the creative director or the record company or the manager or whatever. How it always worked for me was the band had seen my work or they had heard of me, and that was how it all, that's a better way of doing it because it is the process that I described. And for me, I have a certain way. There's the person that inspired me to get into doing this was Roger Dean, which I got to become friends with years later, and I got to meet him. I was a big fan of his work. He was, you know, a brilliant illustrator, great art, but he does different things. And the way he happened to wind up doing record covers was completely by accident. It just sort of happened. And at first, that's how I envisioned myself being. The difference, though, was I was a music freak. I mean, I loved rock and roll. And what I quickly realized was that if I had a certain style, I painted a certain way, that could get me notoriety. But, you know, Rush doesn't want to look like Yes, and Yes doesn't want to look like Led Zeppelin, and Led Zeppelin doesn't want to look like Black Sabbath.
Right.
So you could let's say if you had a style of Frank Frazetta, you could do that kind of art. And there's a chance there's maybe a number of clients may want to use that type of work, but they tend not to. So when I approach how to work with the act, for me, the process is I position myself as to being their fan. And how would one of their fans, what they would expect to see, or how they would want to see their band interpreted. So that's kind of the thought process I do. And then I adapt my style based on that. So the important thing to me is to interpret the music rather than impose my style on the artist. And it was just instinctive at first, but it really paid off in the end for my longevity and the amount of clients I have. So if you're sitting down and talking to Lynyrd Skynyrd, you're in a completely different frame of mind and what your audience expects to see, as opposed to if I'm sitting down and I'm talking to King Crimson.
Right.
You know, and how they approach stuff, or Deep Purple, or Uriah Heep. So that's really the important thing is it's what works. So I'm not prejudiced it's like, oh yeah, it's got to be an acrylic painting. Well, maybe not. Maybe it's a watercolor. Maybe it's a drawing. Maybe it's a photograph. Maybe it's a digital image. Maybe it's a still life. It's whatever interprets the music, whatever mood the music puts you in. And that's how I approach stuff. And that was my big transition. Because I wanted to do comic book art. I wanted to be a comic book artist originally. And then I realized, you know, that I like music more. Mm-hmm. And I gravitated towards that. And then all this artwork that I did for comic books, a lot of the metal bands thought it would be cool to use those record covers, and I got into that. But by the mid-80s, this is what I realized, and that's when I made the change into being an art director, I guess, or a creative director, other than just being an artist. And the first one that I did, which did not involve my artwork, but it was me coming up with a concept, was the Winter of 88 for Johnny Winter, where I worked with Mick Rock, who's been a friend now 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Mick Rock is most famously known for his covers for Queen and for David Bowie. You know, the Queen 2 cover is probably one of his greatest pieces.
Right.
And I also collaborated with Mick Rock again when we did Extreme Porno Graffiti together.
Now, you guys just did a book a few years back too, correct?
I did a book with Martin Popoff.
Okay.
Who's a rock writer, which is the greatest record covers, heavy metal record covers. And that was just us being fans, you know. And then I was also approached by Denny Somach, who did a definitive book on Led Zeppelin. And I did 20 paintings of different careers of Led Zeppelin. And that was a big hit. And now I'm collaborating with Mick Rock, actually, on a project.
Okay.
The project that we're doing is I'm taking some of Mick's most iconic shots. It's something we had been talking about doing for, I don't know, forever. We kind of played with this idea in the mid-80s, but now we're really doing it. And so I take one of his famous photographs, and I reproduce as black and white or whatever, and I put it on the canvas. And then I do my thing on it. So it's a collaboration between me and him. And we're doing a lot of the stuffy stuff. So the first one we did was Freddie Mercury. And the next one is going to be Jerry Garcia. I have my pick. It could be Bob Marley. It could be Keith Richards. You know, we're going to do a whole series of them. And the whole reason we're doing it is, it sounds like I'm just giving you hype, but it's not. It's the real God's honest truth.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing that came about was we were just sitting and we're like, you know, we've been working all these years for art directors and creative directors and this and that and whatever. And man, I just, you know, you want to do something just to do it, you know, not for commerce, but just for art, you know, just two friends collaborating on something, you know?
Right.
No rules. No ideas, no preset expectations. So let's just have fun doing it. you know, and, you know, a lot of the musicians I idolized, that's how it all happened for them. A bunch of kids getting together and jamming. And, you know, I mean, it didn't matter if they became rock stars later or they didn't. At the end of the day, what got them off was that it was them and their friends playing, you know, right. Music, just being together and playing. And they never, the ones who never lost that, if you look at somebody like Rush, that's what it is, you know? It's these two lifetime friends. And then, you know, later Neil Peart, God bless his soul, joined, but it was two kids from the neighborhood who got together and they put together a band.
Right. So, were you ever a musician yourself? Do you play?
I play some guitar, but completely amateur.
Okay.
But it helps you because when you play music, you understand it better and you appreciate it better. So I'm a huge fan of old types of music. Probably the only one I'm not a big fan of, although I get it, is hip hop.
Okay.
But I collect electronic music, hard rock, heavy metal, fusion. I totally get it because the passion comes out from people like that. And you could just feel it. You could feed off of it. And to me, it's like when I hear the music, it's like a soundtrack to a movie or to a picture that hasn't been created yet. So the minute I hear music, I start thinking of it visually in my head, and then I have to get it out. So I probably would be doing this regardless if it was my career or not. Like my wife said, you know, to me, you probably would be doing this even if you pumped gas for a living. That's
right.
What you would be doing, because it comes to me as natural as breathing oxygen, you know.
One of the covers that I always liked, and it's one of those you just stare at and you see different things and you wonder what was going on in the creator of this piece's mind, and that is Shadow Life from Dokken. You got the open heart.
Oh, you saw that. Oh,
you've got all these different people from the past kind of floating like ghosts. The moon's in the background. It's just bizarre. And I look at this and it's just, I'm trying to figure what were you thinking when you created that?
Well, I have to, I was sure. Well, it's not a secret anymore because everybody's going to hear it now. But what happened, there was, at that time, Tom Lipsky, who ran CMC Records and later Sanctuary and everything, a good friend, hit me that month with 5 album covers. And he said, you know, I need all these done. I remember that year that month, I had to do Styx, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Slaughter, Dokken, and a Greatest Hits package. So I was scrambling, you know, this was like early Photoshop days too, also.
Right.
And, you know, everything had to be done by hand, you know, the layouts and all that kind of stuff. You know, the computer, it was 1997, I believe. So 1997. So, I had met a month before, we were friends with the band Marillion.
Okay.
And, the English act and Steve Rothery, their guitar player, had me design a logo for his own offshoot record label. And then he also had me do a cover for a band called Wishing Tree, which was on his label. So I was working on that. And at that point, he approached me, and I can't remember the name of the album, but he said, look, we're recording a new Marillion album. So would you want to do something? And it had to do with the heart. Strange Engine. But he told me, Strange Engine. But he told me it would have to be a heart, something about a heart, and very conceptual like that.
Mm-hmm.
So can you show a series of an evolution of, you know, from a young person to an old person? So it was actually done for a different band, the cover. And this is not unusual because one of my idols is Storm Thurgeson. Yeah.
Oh, Hypnosis, yeah.
He passed away. Look, I worship Hypnosis. And Storm would do the same thing. He would create covers, and then if they were rejected or for some reason didn't come back, he would, you know, just show them to another band. if you thought it was a good piece. And the guy who gave me a heads up on that was James Young from Styx, because he remembers when Storm did his presentation for Styx, and they said, oh, we like that idea on the sketch you showed him. And he said, and he looked in the back of the sketch, and he had seen the name of four other bands with a line going through them who had declined the concert. And that's why he knew the idea he was being presented. Storm had shown it to, like, you know, four other bands that rejected it. So we were racing through this. So Dokken was the last one. I was completely burnt out by that time. So they called me, each one of them. And each one of them had a different idea of what the cover was going to be, which was completely different from the other guy's idea, you know? I mean, like, you know, if one guy wanted an Asian theme, the other guy wanted a Mexican theme. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, that drastic of a difference. And each one told me not to tell the other guys because he wanted to know it was their idea so they wouldn't argue. So I'm bouncing between, usually there's always somebody in the band that makes the decision or is the spokesman for the band. In this situation, nobody was the spokesman for the band, right?
Okay.
But you got to keep them all happy because they're all, you know, members. That was with George Lynch.
Right.
And they had the band, and, you know, they weren't getting along. And at the end, they're running out of time now, and I'm panicking because, you know, I'm showing stuff, and I'm getting, like, one guy likes it, one guy doesn't, and so on. And the manager had to step in, and he says to me, listen, just give me something really cool that you got. I said, well, I got this piece idea. He goes, let me just see it. And I showed it to him. He goes, great, that's the one. We're going to use that one. And I'm like, okay. And I'm thinking, are you sure it's going to work with the title? He goes, yeah, because look at the title. And I said, well, I guess. And he asked, I forget what it was, but it was a few tweaks I wanted to do. The funny story about all this was before cell phones and everything, right? So I had now had gotten accustomed, because of the lifestyle of rock stars, you know, I had the answering machine, and I had one in my house. And, of course, I did the stupid idea of giving my home phone number to Tom, who in turn has gave it to all the rock guys.
Right.
So I would be, like, you know, going to sleep with my wife, and at, like, 1 in the morning or 2 in the morning, you hear the, you know, the voice, you know, the answering machine go off, and it'd be like, you know, somebody, you know, hey, Giannis, want to talk about the cover? It's like, you know, it's 2 in the morning. Like, what? You know, I had a little girl at the time. You know, my daughter was like 4 or 5. And it was like, you know, and Tom would call him up like, you know, listen, this guy has a family. You can't be calling him at 1 in the morning, okay, to tell him this. But the funny story I remember with Dokken, man, was he told me, listen, you got to get George Lynch to clear this, okay? You got to understand it. I don't know if they didn't talk to George Lynch, they didn't explain that to him, they didn't know what the urgency was. But so I kept calling George Lynch, and I get just a voicemail. I would leave messages, right? Once I got him on the phone, he told me, I don't have time because I have to go work out. It was very much the bodybuilding, uh-huh. You know? And I'm like, okay, but this is about the cover. Yeah, well, I'll call you back, and I got some good ideas. Okay, great, you know? So we finished. So I just keep going, and every time the manager would call me and go, have you talked to George yet? And I'm like, he won't return calls, or I can't get him. He's like, oh, I'll get him to call you. So anyways, we finish the artwork, deliver it, it goes to separations, now it's onto the printers, now it's to the distributors, 2 months after I handed it in.
Okay.
And in the middle of the night, at 1 in the morning, I get a call from George Lynch a month later. Okay, Johannes, I know what I want for the cover.
It's too late, George.
I'm like, you know, it's been a month and a half, right? I mean, you realize that, you know, next week you're going to walk to the record store and there's the album. You know, I mean, you know, how does that work with you? And wow. I was just floored. I was like, you got to be kidding me. Of course, he was upset because he didn't have a chance to put in his input in that.
Right. So did he settle for it? Was he happy with it in the end?
I never found out what the deal was. What happened? There are situations like that that happen. Like I, with King Crimson, I had a similar situation to this day. I don't know if Robert Fripp ever liked the artwork that I did. I'm guessing he did because I got a photograph. They all signed it, you know, said to Johannes, thank you for a great job. And it's all signed by them, and Robert signed it, and I know how he is, and I don't think he would sign it if he was unhappy, but I never found out. And that's another story I could tell you, which is really funny, but I don't want to keep you, but I want you to, you know, follow your things. You know, we talk for the next 4 hours, I could tell you stories.
I hear you.
You'll be
got to have a million stories of these. Let's,
the Allman Brothers, the Purple, you name it.
Let's play a little bit of something off the docking album. We were talking about Shadow of Life. We're going to play track number one, which is A Puppet on a String. Give you a little taste of that, listeners. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about technology versus the pen and ink and the paint and brush and how that has evolved in this particular realm of art. Stay with us. We'll be back in about 2 minutes. Give you a little taste of some docking. You a little taste of Puppet on a String. That is the Shadow Life album from Dokken, and the coolest thing about this album, in my opinion, good music, I'm not saying that, but is the album art. It's one of those pieces, you know, they say art is in the eye of the beholder. I would sit there and look at this album cover and just say, what is going on here? And it didn't seem to go so much with the music as it was a separate piece, but it enticed me enough that that's the reason I bought that album from Dokken. Was never a huge fan, but your artwork, Johannes, is what prompted me to open my wallet for them.
Oh, man, thanks a lot. I mean, bless you, because of the arguments that I've had, and I think I mentioned this in the previous interview with creative directors of all people, right? And art directors of all people. Some guys are totally into this, and they get it, and other guys, they just don't care. And somebody, for a fact, told me that, he said, look, don't get so, you know, on your high horse, so mighty about it. At the end of the day, as much money ink and printing goes into your into doing packaging for that as a for a box of cornflakes. At the end of the day, you're just selling a product. Doesn't really matter. You're not here to win any art awards. And I got it. I sort of get the commerce aspect of that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I pointed out to him is that, look, I get it. I get that, you know, the greatest record cover is not going to help if the band, if what it contains is musical garbage.
Right.
And I've seen the situations where famous, great albums, and they have pretty lousy covers, you know, they've gotten done. However, if you get it synced, I mean, you're missing the boat, I said to him, because if you can sync it up perfectly, then it pays dividends in a major league scale for the band, creatively, their prestige, and at the end of the day, for you guys, your bottom line. And the top three examples I can give right off the top of my head is Eric Riggs with Iron Maiden, Storm Ferguson with Pink Floyd, Roger Dean with Yes.
True.
Take somebody like Pink Floyd. If you take the name of the band purely, if you're from Mars, never heard about them, and you say, what's the name of this band? You go Pink Floyd. That's a pretty silly name
right.
to think about.
Especially from the
era. But that's, right. But that's not what you think about. The first thing that comes to your mind is that world that Storm Ferguson created. Other than their incredible musical brilliance. I mean, would Pink Floyd music be any less? Or would Iron Maiden's music be any less stronger if it wasn't for Derek Riggs' artwork? Of course not. Iron Maiden still would have made it. They wrote great songs. However, that character that Derek Riggs created, I could tell you for a fact that at night, they make more money on merchandising when they perform in one night than from the ticket sales.
I can believe that. Eddie is iconic. I have a poster in my record store, and it was when the Iron Maiden Eddie game came out many, many years ago, and it was from the record company. It had all the different images of Eddie on one poster. And people stop and stare at that for the longest time, and then they talk. They try to identify the era of the band by the Eddie, and it just goes to show the power of that artwork.
Yeah, it makes you a fanatic. It becomes your colors. It creates the world. Something like Yes, you know, you hear their music and it's wonderful, but then these incredible landscapes that Roger Dean has painted, this world that he created around them, and all of a sudden, Yes dove right into that. They picked right up on that. The artwork that Hugh Syme did for Rush, you know, 2112, and A Farewell to Kings. And Hemispheres. And we can go on all day. And if you're just a money pincher, let's be honest. I mean, my God, you know, I mean, so tons of T-shirts and posters and that, all because of Roger Dean's work or Hypnosis. I mean, my God, that prism by Storm Thurgeson that he designed, you know.
Dark Side,
Dark Side of the Moon. I mean, that is such an iconic symbol. I'm walking down the street and I see, you know, 16 or 14-year-olds wearing that. They don't even know who Pink Floyd is. For that matter, they haven't heard any of their songs. But somehow they get it that is cool and it's, you know, it's part of the fabric, you know, of into the social fabric.
Right.
It's inclined. And that's just the power of imagery. And that's the important thing. Yeah, I mean, music is a gift, and a record cover is a perfect gift to give, if you think about it, which way it was so big and why vinyl has come back. Because it's one friend saying to another, here's a gift I'm giving you of music and art. And that's what happens when you hand an album to someone.
Let's talk a little about the evolution of album art. Some of the acid era albums of the late 60s, mind-boggling what people did with pen and ink and with paint and brushes, whether it was watercolor or acrylic. Then along comes this beast called technology, and everything seems a lot easier. Less talented folks who lack skills in the old art ways are suddenly crowding the field. How have you embraced technology versus the old ways, and are you seeing that it's getting too crowded because computers have made it too easy to do graphics?
I think best way to answer that is the same with the technology of recording and just musicianship in general, which means at the end of the day, it's your ideas. You're creating an image. It doesn't matter what your palette is. It's okay. The output that matters. So it doesn't matter if you do it digitally, if you do it photographically, if you do it with painting. I mean, you just add it more to the palette, right? I mean, in the late 60s, early 70s, some of the illustrators in London discovered airbrushes, which were primarily used for purposes of, you know, retouching things and painting cars and things like that, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And all of a sudden they go, hey, wait a minute, you know, I could put ink in this and I could do things with this. And, you know, but then stop guys who are doing oil paintings or guys who did acrylic paintings or guys who did watercolor. So there was an explosion of airbrush illustrations. And, you know, I know how to do airbrush, and that's what primarily my artwork was. And then, you know, you had Photoshop come about, and then you had digital art come about and everything. I don't think it really matters. I think all that matters is what you create and how it affects people. I know a lot of people can do it, but at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. The good stuff just stands out. Just like right now, you can record an album in your living room and get all the effects and sounds and everything that, you know, David Gilmour of Pink Floyd does. Does not make you David Gilmour. Your music is just not going to resonate. It just comes down to the basics, you know. Roger Dean technically is not a good artist. Technically.
Hmm. Okay.
I've seen better illustrators, you know, technique-wise, like, you know, when he paints people or whatever. It doesn't matter. The concepts are mind-boggling. So it's not about just the technique. It's about the ideas. It's what he presents. When you see a piece of artwork by Roger Dean, you never forget it because you've never seen anything like it. And I remember having this conversation with, which I'm not going to say who it is, but it was the wife of another famous illustrator. And he's a brilliant artist. And he's old school. You know, he learned the traditional way how to do stuff. And when he paints an apple, it looks like you could take the apple and eat it. Mm-hmm. It looks that incredible, right? And he's a fantasy illustrator. And he sells the stuff for about, you know, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000. And she's looking at his paintings, and she's looking at Roger Dean's paintings at one of his exhibitions, and she sees the price tag. And right now, a Roger Dean goes anywhere from a $400,000 on the low end to $6 million, which is what he's asking for Real Air.
Wow.
Which is primarily just a pencil drawing with some watercolor, right?
Right.
And she goes, I don't get it. She goes to me, he's not that good. How can he ask for six? I mean, who would pay $6 million? In a very polite way, I was trying to get her, like, you don't get it. It's not about his technique. It's about who he is. You know, how brilliant what he does. It's like, you know, trying to compare an Eddie Van Halen guitar riff to Mozart, you know?
Right.
Mozart is Mozart. And Eddie Van Halen is Eddie Van Halen. Each one of them is unique in their own way of what they created. See what I'm saying?
Right.
And that's the important thing. So as far as technology is, yeah, I'm into all that, and, you know, the bells and whistles. But the only time it interests me is, does it give me another option of presenting a concept to my client in a way that I can't do it the other way? So when I sit down and I have that conversation, as we have said, I realize right off the bat, am I going to do something that's going to have a hypnosis flair to it? Am I going to have something that's going to have a heavy metal flair to it? Or am I going to have something that's going to have a progressive rock flair to it? And depending on what I'm going to do is what media I use to interpret my concept. And I don't think technology will ever be able to reply. I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say that. Maybe, I don't know, they'll build robots that are smart enough and whatever someday or whatnot. But, you know, Mick Rock, a great thing he said to me, because, you know, he's seen it all. He's done it all, right? And he shoots digital and everything. And, you know, just saying, you know, I said, Mick, you know, right now, you know, you could just do a program and just create stuff. And he says to me, you know, man, he says, they could create any technology they do, but they will never create a technology that where the camera could see what I see through my eye and my brain and what I want to take a shot. And that's it. That's the difference. I look at photographs by other great photographers, really good. But when I look at a Mick Rock piece, that is a piece of art. Mm-hmm. I don't know how he does it. I don't know how he figures it out. But there's a certain way he lights them. He photographs them. And his photographs become something more than just a photograph of the band or a cover. They become iconic pieces of art.
Yeah.
And again, the Queen II cover, that's a perfect example. It's just a band photo when you strip it all down, but it becomes so much more than that. That is probably the most iconic reproduction of Freddie Mercury I've ever seen of all time, you know?
Mm-hmm. We have about 5 minutes left, and I do want to talk about some of the things you are working on now. We've spent the last year locked down. We're opening up in so many different markets. I'm thinking that for the last several months, you've been bogged down with different projects that you've probably been working on. So what's next? What are we going to see? What bands are you working with? What exhibits are you doing? What books or posters or whatever is coming next from you?
We're going to need about an hour and a half. But and man, I just got to say, you're a great guy, man. I really love talking to you. You know, you're the kind of guy I would love to be able to hang out in a bar, have a few beers and just talk and nothing but music with, you know.
Oh, so I love talking music.
I really enjoy this. This is really cool. There's a stack of album covers that are coming, about two or three new bands. Again, I'm not at liberty to say, but four things I can say specifically, and they're going to eat it up a lot of my time. One is I'm doing a series of images with Mick Rock that we decided to do where it's one of his photographs. I do my thing on it, and we're doing a whole series of them. We did Freddie Mercury. We're going to do Jerry Garcia, Keith Richards, you know. So that's the collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to eat up my time. The second one is I am doing with Denny Somach, we're doing a collectible Beatles project, which is going to be extremely unique. It's going to be the Uber Beatles collectible. Of course, it features my artwork. It comes in the shape of an album cover. It's going to have a DVD that has footage and information and stuff on the Beatles never seen, never been heard before.
Hmm.
It's coincide with the release of the Beatles film that's coming out. And that's a massive undertaking to do that project. And so I'm doing 22 Beatles illustrations, or my take on the Beatles, so to speak.
Is there a target date for that release, either the film or your project?
It's probably going to be early 2022. Okay. From the looks of it, by the time we get done with everything, believe me, we will be talking about that when the time comes. You know,
okay. I'm sure
Chip will contact you about doing something on that.
I'm sure we will.
It's mind-bogglingly cool. So there's that going on. I have an exhibition up at Cape Cod coming up of my artwork in a music venue that's opening up. But it's a combination of a recording studio, memorabilia, rock gallery, and performance area for the wealthy crowd at Cape Cod, and they're collecting that stuff. And I'm also working on a piece of art for Uriah Heep's 50th anniversary, which is going to hopefully be the definitive design, which they're going to use as they embark on their 50th anniversary tour, which was supposed to have been this year.
Right.
By now, it's not happening till early next year, unfortunately.
Now, they have that career retrospective. That's what I was talking with Mick about.
I'm in that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're going to keep busy. We can keep up with everything that you're doing on DangerousAge.com. Is that correct?
Yeah, DangerousAge.com is my website, and obviously Facebook. You know, you can go from there, and I'm also on a YouTube channel and Instagram and all of that social media stuff, and you just keep track with me through all that stuff. But, you know, that would be really cool. I'll tell you something I'd love to do if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
I would either, and the money can go to a charity or something like that, or if you want, or I'd love to send you a signed print of my artwork, and maybe we can give it away to one of your fans.
I would love that. It's funny you'd say that, because I do an event every year called Pet Rock, and we get different signed guitars from Paul Rogers, or we do meet and greet packages, or signed CDs or albums, and it all goes to help the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana for an abused and homeless animals. So I would love to have that.
You could have your choice of the Allman Brothers or Bob Weir or Led Zeppelin. You tell me, and we can get a series of stuff. And this could be something really, really cool, and it would warm my heart to do something this cool.
I would love that, and I will send you our newsletter and information on that. The number that we call to get a hold of you, is that the best number to reach you?
Yeah, that's my personal cell. Please keep that to yourself.
Oh, I will. I will. That's why I'm not saying anything. I just wanted to make sure.
So let's announce it on the air, you know, because, dude, I tell you, with thousands of fans I have on my Facebook and everything, my God, you have no idea the kind of messages and emails I get.
Well, I figure if Dokken can do it, I can do it. What the heck?
Yeah. You can call me at 1 in the morning.
All right. Johannes, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I do want to have you back on when you've got the Beatle Project and some other things ready. Maybe we can get a back and forth with Mick Box and or any of the guys, you know, when that
done. Oh, definitely.
Even if we do, you know, something with you and Mick Rock to talk about the different pictures that you're creating off of his photos. So
I think Mick would love it, and the stories he has about Queen and Bowie would just floor you, absolutely floor you.
All right, well, I'll talk to Chip. I'll text you some information on that charity thing, and we'll talk again soon.
All right, my friend, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right,
let's close out with something from Bananas, one of the interesting albums that he did, the artwork for Deep Purple. I remember interviewing Roger Glover when I was on a previous station about this album, and it's one of those that fell between the cracks a little bit, but it's good. This is the title track. Coming up, we're going to go to the Hard Rock International.
Got nothing to say today. I used my words up yesterday. I'm just lying here in the sun, watching you guys having fun. 7 days, 7 nights. Work until you get it right. Myself. Yeah, I pulled some crackers off the shelf. She had her head done yesterday. Now she's coming out to play. First you pull, then you push. Two in the hand, one in the bush. Oh, my. Some will come to nothing at all.